The date is December 17th, 1989, and we're watching The Wizard. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host,
Colin Stewart.
Hello. So this week, we're looking back at December 1989 when movies and theaters were The Little Mermaid, Back to the Future Part 2, Christmas Vacation, War of the Roses, She-Devil, Driving Miss Daisy, and of course, our movie for today, The Wizard, which earned $14.3 million on a $6 million budget.
And as always, a warning for anyone who may not have seen this movie, which came out 31 years ago, so I mean, the statute of limitations is a little bit expired, but there will be spoilers ahead, so if you don't want the movie to be spoiled for you, then maybe stop this. Go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
So, the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "They're on a cross-country adventure to the world's greatest video championship. It's more than a game. It's the chance of a lifetime." That's a pretty good summary. But that may not be the best description, so let's go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
Alrighty, so, the story follows Jimmy, who is put in a mental institution after attempting to run away from home. His half-brother Corey comes to his rescue, breaks him out, and the pair run off together heading for California. At a train station, Corey meets a girl named Haley and discovers that Jimmy is a master at playing video games. The trio decide to use Jimmy's talents to hustle enough money to continue their journey, now with the goal of entering Jimmy into a competition called Video Armageddon at Universal Studios, which comes with a cash prize of $50,000 for the winner. While the three travelers make their way to California, they are pursued by Corey's brother and father and a bounty hunter hired by Jimmy's parents to bring him back home.
Alrighty. Okay, Colin, let's jump into The Wizard. Directed by Todd Holland, who is mostly known as a TV director. Most notably, he has 51 episodes of The Larry Sanders Show and 26 episodes of Malcolm in the Middle. Produced by Lindsley, not Lindsay, Lindsley Parsons Jr., who is usually a production manager on projects, but he only has 5 actual producer credits. And written by David Chisholm, who has a total of 15 other credits, and all of which are TV shows or TV movies. So like you said, we open on young Jimmy Woods, played by Luke Edwards, who is actually a much busier actor than I expected. To this day, he's still quite a busy actor, been in films like Little Big League and American Pie 2. He was the star of an early 90s TV show I've never heard of called Davis Rules. So when we open the movie, Jimmy is walking down the road and being pursued by an airplane and a cop car. It's kind of my understanding that when we get to know the family a little bit better, that this is the kind of thing that Jimmy does all the time. But do they bust out an airplane every time he decides to run away and goes missing?
The local crop duster.
The local crop duster does.
Flying so low that, I mean, he could have hit Jimmy with a wheel easily.
Yeah. The backstory of this family is a little confusing to me. It doesn't make the most sense. I mean, you know, the cops at this point now pick up Jimmy, take him back to the parents, and this is where we end up meeting three different parents. We've got Bateman, who he doesn't get a first name, he's just Bateman, played by Sam McMurray. Sam McMurray is one of those guys, none of his credits are notable, but
he's in a lot of stuff.
But he's in a lot of stuff. Yeah, name five TV shows, and he's bound to have guest starred on one of them. We meet Jimmy's mom, Christine Bateman, played by Wendy Phillips, who was in Airplane 2, the sequel, 20 episodes of Falcon Crest. And we meet Dad, who is Sam Woods, who is played by Beau Bridges from Fabulous Baker Boys, Charlotte's Web, and an ass load of TV movies. When you look through his IMDb, he's mostly TV movies. But we see these three parents, and they're all discussing the future of Jimmy, and I'm confused by their relationship. It's not really established in the beginning, is it?
Well, yeah, you know that, like, based on Corey's conversation with his dad, that Jimmy is their brother. And, I mean, like, there's a lot, like, that comes out later, obviously, in terms of what happened with the family in the background. There's also, I read, when they filmed this movie, they shot it to script, and when it was all said and done, the movie was 2.5 hours long.
Oh, God.
And so, I mean, the running time of the actual movie as it's presented is only 90 minutes, and there was, from what I read, a lot of more like character development for the older brother played by Christian Slater, and a lot more of the family dynamics played out in that script that kind of got cut. But
yeah, and we'll get into it later too, because like some of the backstory, when we do actually get to figure it out, is really dark, super yeah. super dark, and I can't imagine what a 2.5 hour version of this movie would have looked like if they had kept all that in. That's wild. They've decided on Jimmy's fate. He's going to be going into a mental institution, and we get a scene with Dad at home with the other brothers of Jimmy. We're introduced to Corey Woods, who is played by Fred Savage from The Wonder Years, Princess Bride, Little Monsters, Austin Powers Gold Member. And we're introduced to Nick Woods, played by Christian Slater, who was just kind of the king of the 80s and early 90s. Movies like Heathers, Young Guns 2, Pump Up the Volume, Cuffs, True Romance, Jimmy Hollywood, Interview with the Vampire, Bed of Roses, Broken Arrow, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Mobsters, and now, of course, Mr. Robot.
And the guy looks exactly the same. You know what I mean? Like, he's aged, like, maybe a little bit, but not much.
Yeah, he's got a couple more lines. He's a little bit in his face. He's a little bit thicker. But yeah, Christian Slater is still a very youthful looking guy. So we get introduced to this bizarre family dynamic with these two brothers and Dad Sam. Dad takes a pot off the stove and puts it right on the table, right on the wooden table. This is one of those things that just bugs me for some reason. Anytime in a movie where they do something that you shouldn't be able to do in real life, it just bugs me. And we got a lot of that in The Wizard, because none of the people in this movie actually know how to pretend to play a video game. Especially Beau Bridges, who right here is the one that's guilty for putting the pot on the bare wooden table. We now see Corey Woods upstairs. He's decided that he wants to liberate his brother from the mental institution. Has decided he wants to run away, and in order to pick the places where he wants to run away to, he's throwing darts at the wall, a giant map on the wall. He's just throwing darts at the wall. Sam Woods doesn't seem to have much of a hold over his sons. I mean, there's this family dynamic. It's really confusing. And the whole time he's deciding to run away, Sam is downstairs in a screaming match with his other son, and they're yelling things like, "You let her die," and everything like that. And the whole time I'm sitting there going, I don't actually know who they're talking about. Like, did you mom die? Didn't we just meet mom?
Well, I think even with, like, Jimmy and the mental illness aspect, that was a really confusing thing for me, because Jimmy, from what I can see, has no clear mental illness at all.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they're like, oh, well, he just keeps running away, so we're going to put him in a mental institution, I thought was kind of insane. And I think that that's where I see Corey's motivation coming from, and his frustration with his dad is, like, Corey ends up being all about, like, the family. Like, he's the only one, I think, that sees there's something else going on that we'll get to, like, later in the story.
Yeah. But,
and that's kind of his reasoning for wanting to break Jimmy out and run away.
Yeah, but instead we put him in this home for incurably nutcase children, you know, which is where Corey now takes us is into this home, and it's not a very secure home.
No.
Like, it's not like it's a juvie or anything. Corey just walks in. I don't see, there's one nurse that you see briefly at the other end of the hallway that goes around the corner, and then you don't see a single other adult. Corey manages to get into the house, liberate Jimmy, and get out of there without any consequences, without any confrontations at all. And so because Corey has kidnapped Jimmy, the other parents, the Bateman parents, have now decided to hire Putnam. And Putnam is played by Will Seltzer. He hasn't had any credits since 1994, but I think he's still alive. And according to Wikipedia, he was the backup choice for Luke Skywalker. He almost beat out Mark Hamill to be Luke Skywalker, and I actually watched the video of his audition. And it wouldn't have been a terrible movie if Will Seltzer... But what a different career this guy would have had if he had gotten that role.
But that has to be tough to swallow.
Very much so. He is such a cheeseball, wearing his bolo tie and with his open collar, and he is put on task to find Jimmy and Corey. And Jimmy and Corey have escaped by hiding in a Hostess Cakes Wonder Bread truck. And that brings us to a segment we like to call Sponsorship Corner. So, as always, one of my favorite things in these old movies is the in-your-face product placements, and the Wizard does not let me down. Here we go. The Wizard is brought to you by Hostess Cakes and Wonder Bread, Cosmopolitan Magazine, Nintendo, Vision Streetwear, 7-Eleven, Nintendo, Pepsi, Nintendo, and Universal Studios. This has been Sponsorship Corner. Yeah, Nintendo having a big hand in this movie.
I'm pretty sure half the budget of this movie was provided by Nintendo.
Probably. And Vision Streetwear, they have a surprising amount of placements as well, because when we meet Lucas, that seems to be him and all his goons. That's their entire wardrobe is Vision Streetwear.
I'd never heard of Vision Streetwear, but I love the shirt that Lucas is wearing during Video Armageddon.
Yeah. You got to go see if you can find one of those on eBay or Amazon or something. Someone must have made one somewhere. Maybe you have to go to Etsy to get that one. So we end up with our first montage of the movie, where Corey and Jimmy are going across country doing things like hiding in a phone booth to avoid rain. Corey is quite the little Boy Scout, making fires in the middle of the desert and all that sort of thing. Eventually, we end up meeting Haley, played by Jenny Lewis. She was in Pleasantville, 18 episodes of Brooklyn Bridge. Her latest credit is the Netflix special of Very Murray Christmas, where she's a waitress in that. These days, she's actually a singer. She has 4 albums since 2006. Her latest album was in 2019. I listened to some of it on Spotify. She's not too bad. And with Haley, we end up getting the double dragon bet, because we've put Jimmy in front of a video game and we found out that he's just an absolute savant when it comes to video games. And so they bet Haley that Jimmy can beat her at Double Dragon. This scene is just, it's so dramatic and so intense. You know, them, Corey cheering on Jimmy, you know, and what will the outcome be? I guess this gives Haley some respect for these boys, because she decides that she wants to join them and become part of a cross-country scam, because they don't have money for bus fare. Corey packed everything he needs to be a Boy Scout, apparently, but didn't think to bring enough money for bus fare. But
when you have skills, you don't need money.
Yeah. and Haley has decided that she wants to be part of this. So she takes them to a cafe where while Jimmy plays Ninja Gaiden, they're making plans, and we've got New Kids on the Block playing over the speakers. So we're thrown into this nice 80s moment of playing Ninja Gaiden, and boy, Ninja Gaiden was one of my favorites when I had my Nintendo. But yeah, why can't people in movies play video games realistically? Because we're now brought to the businessmen who have just gotten off work. They've got their ties loosened. They're all standing around playing arcade games. Was this something the businessmen did in the 80s? I was way too young to be a businessman in the 80s. But is after work cocktails and video games, was that a thing?
I feel like, yeah, I don't think in the 80s that video games, like nowadays, video games is definitely an adult. It's like adult entertainment.
Oh, very much, but yeah.
In the 80s, I think it was still mostly something that kids did.
Well, and I think it's adult entertainment now because so much of it is home consoles and online and all that sort of thing. If I can find an arcade, I don't think that you're going to find an arcade that is packed with adults. But meanwhile, like Video Armageddon in this movie, the audience is full of kids. And I know that if that was happening today, the audience would be packed with adults. There's no question about that. But I don't know about hanging around in arcades, whether that's something that they did back then. But they decide to make a bet with these businessmen. They decide to hustle them and end up winning enough money to start making their way further across the country to get to California. I love how Corey, you know, has packed the essential items, and some of those are things like rubber masks and rubber spiders because, you know, those are essentials. But you didn't bring enough money for bus fare. But I guess that just shows that he really is a kid. And we get treated to another montage of them getting across the country, and also with that, Putnam trying to chase them and track them down. So we're seeing both of those happen in these montages, and Putnam crossing paths with the dad and the older son, who are also chasing these guys across California.
It's probably some of like the funnier stuff in the movie is the battle between Sam and Nick and Putnam, like especially that one where they have like their demolition derby on the main street of that small town.
In the middle, in the middle of the street, he's smashing out headlights and backing.
Yeah, they're slashing tires, like javelin throwing a shovel.
but yeah, so during the montage, I guess just before the montage, we see the kids get mugged because they get a ride in the back of a pickup truck and they have their big wad of cash and they end up getting mugged by the guys in the truck. And then we end up with this montage and it's them still trying to get across the country, even though they've had all their money stolen. And in the montage, we have this motorcycle gang picked up. And because of what just happened, my first thought was, oh shit, they're going to get rolled right now again.
Yeah.
What are these bikers going to do to them? But they pick them up and conveniently have helmets for every one of the kids. They don't wear any themselves because they're big bad bikers, but at least they happen to carry 3 spare helmets, I guess, so that the kids are wearing helmets.
Yeah, I feel like this part to me is a part where something got cut out from what was filmed. I just feel like it seemed to me like Haley knew these bikers. Well, that's what I choose to believe anyways. It seems too odd for them to just show up and have like a bunch of kids just go.
Yeah.
That's how you get murdered.
Well, Haley herself is very streetwise, right? Like, even when she first meets Corey, she has her thing about, you know, I will scream, which Corey responds, can you just do it quietly, though, please?
Yeah.
You know, but it is quite possible. She is a very street smart kid, but yeah, I could believe that she actually knows these bikers somehow, or she knows some sort of code of the bikers that will get you a ride. Is there one of those where you can get a ride with any biker as long as you know the secret handshake or something like that?
The code of the road.
The code of the road. And to your theory about maybe this was all part of that longer cut of the wizard that exists out there, it is quite possible that a lot of this movie is montages. There's three, maybe four montages in this movie where they just gloss over so much of the story. And it is quite possible that it was all stuff that was used to be fully fleshed out scenes.
Yeah.
And now, for the sake of the cut, it's like, well, we don't need that. We don't need that. Let's just cut it down and throw some music over it. And there we go. We can move the story along anyway. So they're traveling across the country, and their video game hustle scheme leads them to a small town where they decide they want to challenge the best around. And we get another huge cheese ball. We get Lucas, played by Jackie Vinson.
Jackie Vinson, which brings us to our next section, which is, whatever happened to that guy? Alright, Jackie Vinson played Lucas Barton, Jimmy's greatest rival for video game domination and the master of the Power Glove. He probably owns the best line in this movie, which is, I love the Power Glove. It's just so bad. It's way too sexual for a small child to be delivering, and also makes zero sense. But, it's an okay line. So Vincent didn't do much acting after The Wizard. He had small roles on a TV drama called The Grand, which was about a family of piano makers. And so, he appeared in a movie called Breaking the Rules, which was featured Jason Bateman. His last performance was on an episode of Law & Order in 1996.
That's a rite of passage for 80s actors, though.
Yeah.
Many of the actors that we've researched, they've done a guest shot on Law & Order. The other one is, for any of the 80s actors, it's often Hill Street Blues is one that I come across a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, things kind of went really downhill after 1996 for Vincent. He didn't really do any more acting, and then in 2004, he was charged and sentenced to 10 years probation for child molestation.
What?
And so his final credit that we have on record is as a registered sex offender in the state of New York.
Oh, shit.
You know, I guess it turns out that the Power Glove isn't the only thing that was bad.
Ah, oh, you son of a bitch!
And I mean, I draw a lot of comparisons between even in look between Lucas and Draco Malfoy.
Oh, he's so both, Draco Malfoy.
They're both like very similar and very just like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you've got the blonde fair kid, and I mean Draco Malfoy is a shitty bully.
Yeah,
like Draco Malfoy is all about you're poor, you know, and you have no parents. That's his bullying technique. So, yeah, so Lucas is very much the same, where it's just kind of like, I'm the best that there is, and that's all there is, but it really doesn't matter. Oh,
he reminds me of Malfoy in, like, the first Harry Potter movie, where he's still kind of confident, like, like
he's got
asshole,
that swagger
Malfoy, yeah, before he becomes the sniveling, really weak, annoying Malfoy of the later
yeah,
books and movies.
Right on. Oh, wow. I wonder how often he used the line, I love the Power Glove, later in life. Wow.
That was his pickup line.
That was his pickup line. What a scumbag.
Everything
that's funny.
Just so bad.
Wow. Okay, so yeah, we've met Lucas, and Lucas pulls out the Power Glove, and he completely dominates against Jimmy on the video game, and Jimmy walks away from him, decides not to challenge him, seemingly because he's intimidated by how good Lucas was with his power glove. And even Haley thinks that it's all about her. She's telling Corey that, no, he's jealous of me, is what she says to Corey. And this is where we find out they're hanging out in an abandoned drive-in movie theater, and one of the groups of teenagers that they hustled managed to find them and end up mugging them. So these kids are absolutely terrible at holding on to their money. But in the scuffle, Jimmy's lunchbox that he's been carrying around bursts open, and we find out that Jimmy has, like, serious PTSD.
Yeah.
Because he watched his twin sister drown. Like, no wonder he's that way. Do 1989 adults just not understand emotional trauma? They throw him in a mental institute, but this kid watched his twin sister die, and, like, he's traumatized. Why don't you adults understand this? You know, and now the backstory starts making a whole bunch more sense. The whole argument about you let her die and all that sort of thing. You kind of, you see why everybody is divorced, why everybody is separated, why everybody seems to have this wedge of tension between every single relationship in the movie. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why the reaction to this kind of emotional trauma is, let's chuck him in a mental institution.
Well, I think it's interesting for us to look back on it with, like, 2020 eyes, where, you know, like, mental health is such a huge thing now, and, like, yep, taking care of people's mental health is a big priority for lots of employers, just society in general, where I really just don't think it was back then. Well, I don't think you had that. It was still, mental health was a lot more stigmatized back then. It was less understood. There was more of that expectation that people just kind of, like, you know, figure it out and move on with their life, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess back in 1989, Ritalin probably existed. Prozac probably existed. But I guess I'm glad that they didn't just say that this kid needs Prozac. Let's throw Prozac at him.
Or lobotomy.
But, yeah, locked in a cage seems like it. Yeah, or a lobotomy, shock therapy. Locked in a cage just kind of seems like, it is hard to see that with 2020 eyes. Yeah. 2020 vision, as it were. Oh.
It's also interesting in the story that comes out about how she drowned and everything. It's like, it's kind of insinuated, like, Nick was responsible for them.
Yeah.
And he wasn't paying attention or watching or something like that, and all this happened, and, you know, she drowned. And going back to the longer cut of this movie, one of the things I read was that there is a chunk cut out of the movie that deals with Nick's alcoholism.
Okay.
And so it's interesting to think about that in this story, and just kind of, and even his interactions with it. There seems to be a strained relationship between Nick and Sam. Like, they have that scene in the motel where Nick's trying to, like, actually talk and connect with him, and Sam just is kind of, like, blowing him off, and it seems like he's uninterested, and there's some friction there. And also between Nick and Jimmy's mother, like, there's a blame or a fear between the two. And so when you add that aspect of it, it kind of becomes a little bit clearer.
It's so fucking but, like, dark. Very dark. Very dark. And I mean, you mentioned it at the beginning where you were saying how youthful Christian Slater still looks after all these years. I don't even know how much older he is supposed to be than everybody else. So, you know, there's something about the fact that, like, Christian Slater is from one marriage and that mom died, and is that what it was? Is Christian Slater's mom is actually dead, so, you know, Corey and Jimmy and the twin sister were actually belong to the other mom.
I think Nick and Corey are, like, full blood.
Yeah.
With, like, a different woman, and then their dad had Jimmy and Jimmy's sister with the now Mrs. Bateman is how the family dynamic
so it out. Gets even more dark because we've now got another dead mom, we've got the divorce, we've got the dead sister, like, yeah. Tragedy just follows this yeah. family
around. Because there's the whole thing of that, even when they're talking at the dinner table, where Nick and Corey feel like, or even when Corey tells the story, he feels like Mrs. Bateman, their former stepmother, never really liked them, or never really wanted them or accepted them as their children.
Oh yeah, right, that, right, I forgot about that. Well, anyway, so, yeah, we finally get some insight into this backstory, which I guess would have been cut out of the 2.5 hour version. The gang gets to Reno, and this is where we get to meet Spanky, played by Frank McRae. He was in Batteries Not Included, Vacation, 48 Hours, Last Action Hero, License to Kill. License to Kill, he played a character called Sharky. I found it funny when I was looking up the names for these characters that Spanky is spelt with an E-Y, because I wouldn't have spelt it that way. And Sharky is spelt the same way, where it's E-Y at the end. And I just thought, well, that's serendipitous right there or that's something.
Somebody created those names who's really bad at grammar.
Yeah. he was a Chicago Bear in 1967, played 6 games as a defensive tackle. So we meet Spanky, and he is gambling for the kids. He's playing the craps table while Haley is off to the side screaming out suggestions of where he should put his bets. Now they take the money that he has earned them and give him $5 for his trouble. $5 for risking jail time is what he gets for his troubles. And they presumably check into a hotel or something, because they seem to be making themselves comfortable in this hotel while they learn to play all the video games that ever were. That seems to be the thing that they're doing. But they're lounging around the pool while Jimmy is just in the arcade.
Haley's on the phone with the power line.
Haley is on the phone with Nintendo Help. Yeah, with Nintendo Power Helpline. This was before the internet. I used to get Nintendo Power Magazine, and I could have sworn that these helplines were 1-900 numbers. So are they paying like $1.99 a minute to talk to this guy and get all the tips of every game? Like, how big is that phone bill? How much did he win at craps? Like, these kids seem to have a seemingly endless supply of money. Corey gets to be, you know, a hot, high-rolling, hot-shotting, misogynistic pig at one point when the candy girl walks by. And, you know, he says, "Hey, toots," to the candy girl, and, like, you know, tells her to keep the change. Like, he might as well have just slapped her on the ass and said that there's your tip, baby, or something like
that. I feel like that was a big trope of the 80s, 80s and 90s kids movies, of having, like, there was just something so funny about seeing little kids behave like adults.
Well, you look at Home Alone as an example, you know, how him shaving, it's like, oh, ha ha ha, yeah. He's shaving and he doesn't need to. This brings us to another montage, because we're playing video games, she's on the phone, everything like that. They're lounging around the pool, and Putnam manages to find Jimmy while this is happening. And so They run back into the casino because Putnam grabs Jimmy and he's trying to get him out of there. And Haley screams at the top of her lungs in the middle of this crowded building and yells, "He touched my breast." Clever. I'll give her that. This is definitely a streetwise kid. But later on, Putnam is on the phone to the parents and he says under his breath that, "Touched her breast. She doesn't even have breasts." And ugh, that just that one made me throw up a little bit in my mouth. That was, why, adult man, don't comment on a 13-year-old's chest area developments. Like, let's not, you know, let's not be Lucas. Let's not be Jackie Vinson, who obviously has a thing for young kids later on. Let's Like, that makes it even grosser is the fact that Jackie Vinson ended up having this registered sex offender future ahead of him.
Yeah.
And they have this really cringeworthy moment in this because they actually mention the breasts a bit in just a few minutes here, too, where it's just... I heard that when Nickelodeon plays this movie on TV, they cut out all references to her breasts. So obviously they don't think it's okay to be talking about minor sexual assault. So yeah,
I think it's funny when she does it. The first time it was funny because it's just like something you don't expect. Like you don't expect a child to be that aware of like, oh, I can use this to. But then everything that comes after is just kind of.
Yeah.
I could have done without that.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my thought is for her to do it, it's very clever. Absolutely clever. But yeah, for them to keep referencing it, that's where the issue lies with me. Yeah, we get a flash of Sam and what's the older brother's name again?
Nick.
Sam and Nick. I keep wanting to call him Christian Slater just because that's who he will always be to me. We get Sam and Nick. They're at the junkyard. They're through all their battles with Putnam. Their car managed to get towed because Putnam bribed a tow truck driver to tow their truck, and they ended up scrapping the car. So they're sitting there waiting for their car to be put back together. And they've got this Nintendo that they've been carrying around to all the motels and everywhere they go and just hooking it up to random TVs everywhere they go. And when they're ready to leave, Dad takes the Nintendo and never unplugs it from the back of the TV. See, this is just like the pot on the table. Bo Bridges, you gotta pay attention. You gotta unplug a Nintendo from the back of the TV before... See, it's those things that just take me out of the moment. I know how much of an effort it is to screw that thing into the back of a cable jack. that was always annoying to me. And he just grabs the Nintendo and goes. It bugs me. But yeah, they're still on the trail, but they don't realize that Putnam has Jimmy. Jimmy is in his back seat. Putnam decides to throw suckers at Jimmy. I think that's one of my favorite Putnam lines is just he tosses lollipops over his shoulder and just says, "Have a sucker." I don't know why that line is just so funny to me. But as Putnam is driving around, he ends up being boxed into this weird canyon area by four trucks because Haley has called in some favors.
I was just going to say, it's kind of weird that it seems like Putnam's actual career choice is returning escaped children. So he has, like, candy there for the event that he captures them and has to haul them back to, like, placate them for whatever the
trip.
Yeah,
yeah.
But the other people who do that are, like, pedophiles with their, like, creepo vans and, like...
There's two types of people that have a glove box full of candy.
I just have to think that career was short-lived and only lasted for maybe that period of time during the 80s where it was fashionable for kids to run away.
Yeah, because the good guys with candy in their glove boxes were given a bad name eventually. But at least he's not driving like a windowless van. At least he's got a regular sedan, even if it is all smashed up.
Even if the back end is smashed in.
Yeah, so Haley has called in some favors to some trucker friends, and they box him in a canyon area. And this is where Spanky gets out of the truck and says, "So, you touched her breast." And we're left to assume that Putnam, until we see him later, we're left to assume that Putnam has been murdered by the other three truckers. Because Spanky decides to drive them the rest of the way. Why didn't he just drive them the rest of the way in the first place? But
ultimately, it seems like they could have just called Spanky way at the beginning to pick them up and drive them to California.
He seems like he would do anything for this Haley girl. And I don't even know why, because we don't even get to meet Haley's parents. We don't understand what her relationship is with him
yet,
or anything. She just seems to have all these adult friends, but he drives them. And I don't understand why it's necessary to say that Spanky stole the rig. Like, he's driving them to California, and they say that he stole the rig. Why couldn't he have just been a trucker, right? You know, and then to top it all off, looking at, you know, 2020 sensitivity and everything like that, you are also taking the only black person in the movie and making him a car thief. But besides that, I just don't understand why we have to take this one character that seems to be one of the nicest characters in the movie and just make him this petty criminal. Like, it was bad enough that he was risking jail time to gamble for Haley. But, you know, now you've made him, like, Grand Theft Truck. Like, yeah. So he drives them to the rest of the way to California in this presumably stolen rig. I don't understand the logic of that one line of making him a car thief as well, on top of all the other shady things that he's doing for this Haley girl.
I think even the aspect of the character being, like you said, he's the only minority character in the movie, and he just, like, has zero autonomy. You know what I mean? Like, he can't. It's like, for whatever reason, he's at the whim of a 10-year-old girl.
Yeah,
like, he has no ability to say no. He just does whatever she asks, like, no questions asked.
No questions, and gets $5 for his trouble, so I guess he's getting paid for it, if you can call, you know, enough for maybe, I guess, 1989, maybe a Big Mac meal over at McDonald's. You might have been able to get one of those and have some change left over to make a couple phone calls. Yeah, it's mind-boggling to me why they felt the need to do this. But maybe in the 2.5-hour cut, there's kind of more of an explanation about Spanky. Maybe Spanky was given 5 minutes of screen time in this movie, but he actually had, like, a big character arc where you get to actually see him stealing the rig or something like that. I don't know. Because we never do find out how she knows Spanky, so, you know, maybe her dad is a criminal too, and Spanky is one of his associates. Is always, you know, her dad is in prison, and Spanky is left on the street to kind of take her under his wing until he's out, maybe.
What her dad's job was, but her mom was a go-go dancer who clearly had like a gambling addiction.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, is I don't know whether I can believe anything that Haley says at any given time. You know, like, yeah, she's talking about her mom having, like, legs for days and everything.
Well, especially because she paints her life as being so luxurious, and then when you finally see her house, which is a trailer in the middle of the desert.
In the middle of nowhere, like, you know, okay, if you own all that land, maybe that's impressive. Maybe you guys own 100 acres. You know, that makes you a great landowner. But yeah, it's a trailer in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, and she's built up her life to everything is great. And we see that, you know, the truth is that it's a little bit sad. So they get to Universal Studios. I'm no expert on theme park admission rules, but I don't think you can just walk into Universal Studios, even in 1989, but that's what they seem to do. They, you know, they don't seem to pay anything to just walk right into the amusement park. It's this movie is the reason. At this point in my life, I had never actually been to Universal Studios, and it was this movie that made me so excited to go to Universal. We get to see Video Armageddon finally. They managed to check in, and, like, they barely made it in time. Like, they are literally in the last group. They sign in, and the guy says, "Get in there, get in there, get in there." And Jimmy is literally in the last group of competitors. I will say that it for a video game competition and the stigmas that come with being video gamers, I am impressed to see so much female representation in this scene. On stage, Jimmy is playing mostly women. When it comes to the finalists, we've got one girl and two boys. So, and even in the crowd is full of teenage girls. But yeah, all the only adults in the building are the ones that are running this competition. So maybe there was an age limit that I didn't see when they find the advertisement for this video game competition in the magazine. Maybe there is something there that it is a 16 and under only competition, but it might just be 1989.
Yeah, I just think there was no market. Adults. I just don't think adults played video games in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, I know that, like, I'll play video games with my kids now, but I don't think my parents ever sat down and played video games with me when I was a kid, so...
No.
Then I've got another one of these little details that bugs me. They might have a better chance of playing the video games if the Nintendos were actually on. As they're panning past everybody playing their video games on stage, the little red light isn't on any of them. Just one of those little details that bugs me. Jimmy wins in qualifying. He's going to the top three. And now everyone has arrived at Universal Studios. And so they get a break before the final round. They go outside for some fresh air. We're standing at the top of the stairs seeing Lucas and his Vision streetwear goons. And we've got one of his goons delivers this, or I don't know if the line is terrible or whether it's just his delivery of it, but he talks about, you know, hey, next time rip his gizzards out, Lucas. Like I think it was just badly delivered. Like, the line wasn't very good anyway, but he's standing right next to our subject for this week's Bit Player Spotlight. Today we take a look at Lucas's Armageddon goons, but more specifically the one standing to his right, our left. Someone who started out in commercials, he's making his film debut in his pink t-shirt and 80s mullet, a young man who doesn't even need a line for his presence to be felt, Tobias Vincent McGuire, born June 27, 1975 in Santa Monica, California. Tobias didn't finish high school, getting a GED later instead, so that he could pursue and focus on acting full-time. Someone must have seen him in The Wizard because the Fox series Great Scott, he landed the lead on that series. After that was canceled, he found his way in movies like The Ice Storm, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Pleasantville, where he would have appeared with Jenny Lewis for the second time, Cider House Rules, and Wonder Boys. An avid vegan and someone who doesn't use drugs or alcohol, it was when he landed the role of Peter Parker in Spider-Man that Tobias really started to get recognized. I forgot to mention, he goes by Toby now. Toby, not Tobias. Yeah, that's right. Toby freaking McGuire makes his film debut in The Wizard. Sometimes you can't discount the small parts because you never know who you'll see. And that's Bit Player Spotlight. So, Lucas, at the top of the stairs with his goons, he sees Putnam down below and points out Jimmy to Putnam, and everybody flees into Universal Studios, and they end up on the Universal tram ride, which seems to be just parked in the middle of nowhere. Like, when I finally did get to go to Universal Studios, I realized that that's a ride that has a lineup. It doesn't just park in the middle of the park wherever you're hoping to hop on. But everybody gets onto this tram ride. We've got Sam and we've got Nick and we've got Putnam and we've got Corey and Haley and Jimmy. They all manage to make their way onto this tram ride, and as they're doing this chase through the crowds of people trying to climb over seats and everything like that, we hear the tour guide mention a film that is currently in production at Universal Studios called Mayhem in Monte Carlo, starring Pee Wee Herman and Zsa Zsa Gabor as the romantic leads. I want to see that movie. That sounds like a fantastic movie. But they end up in the King Kong ride, and as if security wouldn't be all over them for getting out of the King Kong ride. Like, they climb out of the tram, and they climb down to, like, the authorized personnel. Like, why hasn't security been called at this point? There's obviously some sort of ruckus going on the tram ride. But then we get into a situation where the geography of Universal Studios makes no sense to me, because they end up getting off of this tram ride, climbing down a ladder, but the tram, like, the building they climb into is street level. But they end up climbing down, and then they go through a side door, and then somehow they're actually like 50 feet above the Video Armageddon stage. I don't understand where they are. I need a map of Universal Studios. It doesn't make any sense to me. But somehow they've managed to find an elevator that will take them down onto the stage. So the host of Video Armageddon is on stage wondering where his third contestant is and has just given up. And finally they lift the curtain and there is Jimmy just standing there hanging out. He's chosen his console already, just hanging out with his lunchbox. And everyone just loses their shit because what a reveal. Oh my god. But then it gets even more exciting because they are going to play a game they have never played before. It's Mario 3! Super Mario Brothers 3! Oh wow. Now, I'm looking at this final round where they've all got their consoles. And the consoles themselves, it doesn't seem fair that they're not playing this final game with regular Nintendo controllers. And they're not even playing with regular arcade controllers. If you look at the stick, like the joystick that they're using, it's like twice the height of a regular joystick. And the ball on the end of it is bigger than like my gear shift knob ball. It doesn't seem fair to give the finalists this thing. But, like, I have to say that this whole final battle doesn't make much sense anyway. How the scoring works and everything like that, the announcer is always yelling out things that doesn't make sense. That's contradicted.
The scores that the announcer yells out over the PA system never match what they then cut to when they show them on the actual screen.
Yeah. Well, and there's a whole bunch of where he's saying, you know, World 2. Oh, he has to go back to the beginning of World 2. And you see right on the screen, no, they're on World 1. Like, read. All you have to do is read. It's not that hard. Yeah, they really contradict and, you know, don't follow continuity when it comes to the scores, that's for sure.
The thing that I don't get is, like, the warp ends up being, obviously, how Jimmy manages to get the upper hand and finally, like, come back from behind and win the game.
Yeah.
But it's like they've never played the game before. Like, how do you know? How do you know that the warp even exists?
Haley is sitting in the crowd screaming, the warp, find the warp. Like, you know, so obviously he must know, or he's listening to Haley, but how Haley knows, like,
there would have been no power line for this game.
Yeah. Like, well, maybe the power line was like, hey, by the way, you know, except her reaction when she finds out that it's Mario 3 is that we've never played that game. We've never even heard of that game. I was thinking maybe the guy at Nintendo Power gave her a tip that, oh, by the way, Super Mario 3 is coming out. Let me drop some knowledge on you about that one.
Yeah.
There's a like, couple
it's just
things
kind of, it's just
know.
Kind of ballsy for Jimmy to even go for the warp because it's one of the, and maybe if they had explained this, it would have been even more like heightened stakes or whatever, but I mean, if he flies up there and there's no warp, then he's basically screwed. He's gonna lose the game.
Yeah.
So that's like a last ditch effort.
Well, yeah, like even if the announcer had said, hey, just so you guys know, there's a warp you can find.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, and so all the parents have now shown up in the crowd. They're all cheering them on. And Dad's yelling, Jimmy, watch the mushrooms. Come on, you've just spent the last few days playing this game. You should know that the mushrooms are good things, Bo Bridges. They're not bad things. The things you might be referring to are Goombas, not mushrooms. You don't yell at your son to watch the mushrooms. You want him to get the mushrooms. That's a good thing. Ah, Bo Bridges, do your homework. Yeah, so he finds the warp. He launches ahead of everybody in the scores. Jimmy is the winner. And then he gets, then they're driving home. And Jimmy is riding now with,
there's not even, like, the thing I found funny is there's not even a big celebration.
Yeah.
Jimmy wins the game and then literally just stands there.
Well, but like that's...
a, with, like, a half smile.
That's how Jimmy has been. Yeah, I mean, like, Jimmy is just such a... He's just such a mellow character to begin with that having a just a little smile, that's more emotion than he's shown for the movie. I have to say that Luke Edwards playing Jimmy, I know he doesn't have to say much, but he actually conveys quite a bit in his silent portrayal. Like, I think he's actually a pretty solid actor in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, there's no big celebration, no big celebration scene. We just now see Jimmy riding home with the Batemans. Mom and Bateman they're the ones driving him home because I guess they're the ones that sicked Putnam on him in the first place. So they're taking responsibility for Jimmy. But as they're driving home, Jimmy looks out the window and starts saying California, California, because he sees the dinosaurs in the desert of California. I forget what those dinosaurs are.
Cabazon dinosaurs.
The Cabazon dinosaurs, which make an appearance in Pee-wee's Big Adventure as well. So Jimmy is saying California, California. He's going nuts in the back seat, trying to get out of the car in the back seat. I'm amazed that he doesn't manage to do it because I don't think cars back then had child locks on the doors. He's not able to open the door, though. But so they pull over, and Sam, who is following in his truck with his overloaded front seat of his pickup truck, decides to pull over, too, and see what happens. And Jimmy just beelines it for the dinosaur and somehow manages to get in. These dinosaurs aren't locked up. They're not secure. And when we get to the top of the dinosaur, there's a gift shop in the dinosaur's head, and no one manning this gift shop. Like, this place effectively looks closed.
Yeah, I mean, even the door that they enter through looks like a fire escape door. It doesn't look like the entrance into a store of
any kind. So it wasn't fastened properly, and somehow they managed to get into this dinosaur head. Yeah, where there's a gift shop and they're just hanging out in, you know, a closed store or whatever. But this is where we find out that Jimmy's plan all along of why he wanted to get to California and all this sort of thing was because he wanted to lay the memory of his sister to rest in the place where probably the last place he remembers happy family memories. Because when we see the picture that is inside the lunchbox to represent California, it's a picture that has the happy family. It has Beau Bridges and Mrs. Bateman and all the brothers and the twin sister. This was the last place they must have been happy. And this is where he wants his sister to remain for eternity. So he leaves his lunchbox behind as a tribute to his sister. This is where Mrs. Bateman decides to say, "Why don't you take our boys home, Sam?" How about because he's already in an overpacked truck and you have a four-door sedan? How about you take Jimmy and at least one other boy home? And then we gotta wonder, like, is he gonna be swinging by through Reno as well to drop Haley off? Or has Haley been adopted now at this point? And we end up seeing the kids all riding in the back of the truck. Thankfully, he had seatbelts. At least they made sure that there was seatbelts in the bed of a pickup truck.
Haley's like Sloth at the end of Goonies. They're just like, "We're taking you home with us. You're going to be our new sister/girlfriend.
Yeah. Weirdly. Yeah. And so, yeah, then we've got the end of The Wizard.
I would have loved it if after they dropped the lunchbox, Jimmy just starts speaking in full paragraphs, and it's like all of a sudden,
he's cured! Yeah, now that I got that off my chest. Well, yeah, because much like how we said with Goonies, what does the next day look like? It kind of makes me wonder, does Jimmy, have they decided because he is a savant at playing video games that now he doesn't belong in a mental institute? Like, have they decided that, no, he's normal now? Or do they end up forcing him back into this home? Or like you said, maybe now he just starts getting chattery. Maybe now you can't shut Jimmy up. Whew! I've been keeping that in for 2 years. Like, I don't even understand the timeline. I don't even understand how long ago Jimmy's sister died, because when you look at the picture, everyone in the picture is the same age, but you have to assume that Mom has been with Bateman long enough to actually have a full relationship, and I don't know. We need that 2.5 hour cut. We need the Snyder cut, or I guess in this case we need the Holland cut of the Wizard. We need to know everything that's going on with the Wizard. But that is the Wizard. Oh boy, Colin, on IMDb it scored 6.1 out of 10. That's 13,657 reviews, gave it 6.1. The critics, the Metascore, they gave it 23 out of 100. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 32% from the critics on the tomato meter and an audience score of 60%. So audiences are around the 60% mark, and critics are around, you know, are in the 25 to 30 mark. Oh. Where does it fall for you?
I'd give the movie a solid, like, 75%, a nice B.
Yeah.
I gotta say, this movie wasn't all what I thought it was going to be. When I'd never heard of it or watched it before, and when I just saw the title, I thought it was gonna be one of those movies where, like, a kid goes back in time with modern technology.
Oh, like King and Kids Arthur, or Kid and King Arthur's Court, or whatever that movie's called. Yeah, like,
convinces the people back in time that they're a wizard of some sort, and...
Yeah.
It took me about, I don't know, 20 minutes to realize that wasn't the movie I was in for. But I did really enjoy the movie that I got. It was a lot of fun, and I would definitely watch it again.
Yeah, you know, all our, you know, my little pickinesses aside of not unplugging certain cables and putting hot pots on tables, it was still a fun time for me, that's for sure. I'm just glad, though, because I never fully understood the what was going on with the backstory. I mean, I was from a two-parent household, and so even the idea of a divorced family was something that was foreign to me. So watching the backstory then, I probably didn't even have any idea what was going on, but for 11-year-old me, it was all about the Power Glove, it was all about Nintendo. I was a big Nintendo junkie, so the fact that at 41, I still can't quite understand the full dynamic of the backstory, at least I know it wasn't just me being naive. It's just a confusing backstory.
Yeah.
So for that, it does make me feel like it's a muddled mess. It really is a movie of montages and video game playing. But I still had fun with it. I can definitely get behind the 70%. I'm gonna go a bit lower than you. Yeah, I'm gonna go at 70. You're at 75. Yeah, because I feel like rating it higher than the 60% that the average person is giving it, and I had fun with it. Well, that's The Wizard, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to Apple or Spotify or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say, but it's, oh God, it's those 5 stars that just drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. And follow us on Facebook at I Used to Like This One Facebook group. Follow us on Instagram at I Used to Like This One. And follow us on Twitter at I Used to Like This One with numbers instead of words. On social media, you'll get heads up on what our next movie is if you want to watch it ahead of time.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music, one of my favorite bands. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.